This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As football crashes toward the bowls, a long and painful trail, and soccer set to find a champ in Texas, let's not fail to recognize the landscape's very crowded in the fall. It's time already for some talk of college basketball. Joining me now for that purpose is Pat Forte of ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. I am awed by your verse.
Well, you're easily awed, but we'll move right along to basketball. The Florida Gators are the defending national champs. During the team's celebration last April, forward Joakim Noah, the sophomore sensation of the tournament, announced that he would skip the NBA draft, and he has, in fact, done that. He's been true to his word. He's returned to Gainesville for his junior year. Is he insane?
Yes, I think absolutely. As a matter of fact, Big Baby Davis, who's both large and largely entertaining from LSU at the SEC Media Days last month, said that he opined that Noah was completely off his rocker for having come back. And I think everybody who has to play against him in the SEC would agree. But you know what? It's definitely college basketball's gain and the NBA's loss, because not only is he just an electrifying player, but a really charismatic personality, and is going to really help make this an interesting season to watch.
There's no danger that he'll actually get an education, is there?
3 years, you know, you never know. He's teetering towards diplomatum, I would imagine, at least by the end of this year. But, you know, I would, if he's around for a fourth year, he really will have to be straitjacketed and interred somewhere.
The Gators are the number one team in the nation, and many feel they have the best chance to repeat as champs since Duke did that in 1992. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. You know, I think that they just dominated everyone with the exception of Georgetown in the NCAA tournament, only had one close game, and just got better and better as things went along. It kind of snowballed for them. It's not a guarantee that you can bottle that and bring it back, because Arkansas looked like they were going to come back and win the championship in 1995 after winning it in 94. They didn't make it. They got to the championship game. There's been some other teams that you thought, you know, in November looked unbeatable. I'm sure somebody will beat Florida somewhere along the line, but I'm not sure who, and they definitely deserve to be the heavy favorite going into this year.
Most experts, and that includes the experts from a website that we won't name, but it sounds like ESPN.com, say that Florida, Kansas, and North Carolina are a cut above the rest of the nation and will eventually be filling out the Final Four in late March. At the risk of contradicting your colleagues at that website we didn't name, isn't this a bit premature?
Certainly, of course. Everything's premature in November, but, you know, we live in the prediction business. The thing is, those three teams all look tremendous on paper, but, you know, pitfalls are everywhere. Injuries, chemistry, that's the one thing I look at Florida and wonder. They played so well together last year. Can you possibly bottle that again, or will some guys start playing for the league, as it were, for their draft position? Kansas, incredible talent there, but let's remember they've lost in the first round two straight years. North Carolina got bounced fairly early last year, so nobody's invincible, but on paper, those three teams, I can't argue with them as the heavy favorites.
Speaking of how things look on paper, Ohio State, on paper at least, has the best freshman class of any school since Michigan's so-called Fab Five back in the early 90s. This group, which has been called by some the Thad Five, clever, see, because the coach is Thad Mata, very funny, includes center Greg Oden. He's the number one pro prospect in the country. Oden's out until December with an injured wrist, but could this team advance far into the tournament?
Absolutely. To me, having seen Greg Oden play in high school, he's the next Patrick Ewing, and if you remember Ewing's immediate impact on the college game, taking Georgetown to the national title game as a true freshman, I think he can do that sort of thing. He's not going to, I don't think, score 30 points a game, but he's going to make it really hard for entire teams to score 30 points a game. He's a brilliant defensive player, very intimidating, blocks shots left and right, rebounds very, very well, and to me, you thought Noah was insane for coming back. If he comes back after this year, then we've got flat-out anarchy on our hands.
Now, Pat, I've done my homework this week. I went onto the Internet. I saw a picture of Greg Oden, and supposedly he's 18 years old. But is there any chance that he was born in the same Dominican hospital as Danny Almonte?
I think there's an excellent chance. And there have been very, very intimidated young Hoosier teenagers who have been saying the same thing, I guarantee, in the state of Indiana throughout his career playing against him. I mean, could you imagine going out for the jump ball, you know, and you got to jump against him?
And your voice hasn't changed.
Yeah, exactly. It would be a very intimidating sight. And that's, not only is his game progressed beyond his years, but physically he does look the part of a 5-year NBA veteran.
This year, our good friend Texas Tech coach Bob Knight is likely to become the all-time winningest coach in Division I history, and I hope my grammar teachers will forgive me for winningest. I'm not sure when that became an adjective. But anyway, this is, of course, if Knight doesn't get fired for boorish behavior first. How will he celebrate this achievement?
You know, hopefully not by grabbing anybody by the throat, the arm, throwing vases at anybody, pushing anybody into a trash can, stalking after a referee, throwing a chair across the floor, perhaps with a dose of humility. But, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath for that. The one thing is, he'll be celebrating it in Lubbock, which is certainly not in his grand design when, you know, he began coaching, and that's the price he has paid for his behavior. You know what, if he sets the record, more power to him, because he's been a brilliant coach for all that time. It's just the only thing that's kept him from being one of the great heroes in the history of college sports is if he could just act like a decent human being along the way.
Moving out of the Big 12, which conferences are going to be especially intriguing this year?
I think the SEC is the most interesting it's been in a decade. They not only have the defending champions who we've talked about, they have LSU coming back off a Final Four berth. With Big Baby Davis playing center.
What a great name.
And what a great character. The SEC is not just good, Bill, it's interesting. And you haven't been able to say that in a while, because they have got personality galore. You've got Noah, you've got Big Baby Davis, you've got Bruce Pearl wearing garish orange suit coats on the sidelines and mixing it up with student sections all over the SEC. Alabama's going to be very good. You mentioned all this stuff, and we haven't even got to Kentucky yet. You know, the school that's basically carried the conference for decades, and you know it's a good year in the league when you can talk about four teams and five or six players and not mention anybody from Big Blue.
Especially when you're talking to a guy in Louisville.
That's right.
Pat Forty covers college basketball, among other things, for startup website ESPN.com, something like that it's called. I'm not sure. Pat, thanks again.
You betcha, Bill. Enjoy the season.
During the 1990s, the Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen Bulls grabbed 6 NBA titles. Shortly after Chicago's last championship in 1998, fans endured the Fred Hoiberg, Tim Floyd era, a 6-year skid during which the Bulls registered an abominable 261 winning percentage. But as Ron Schachter reports, the Bulls are building on 2 consecutive playoff appearances and a roster that matches a group of young gunners with 1 old pro.
At one entrance to Chicago's United Center, a life-size bronze statue of Michael Jordan, basketball in hand, seems to hang in space, soaring towards an imaginary slam dunk. The Bulls haven't reached many basketball heights since winning their last NBA title in 1998, but they have turned around their losing ways, which Coach Scott Skiles calls a good beginning.
They've come far enough to play in the first round of the playoffs and get beat. You know, which is good. I mean, you know, you want to get in the playoffs. The franchise spent 6 years out of the playoffs, so now we've gotten back in and haven't been able to advance.
The Chicago Tribune's K.C. Johnson has covered the Bulls for more than a decade and says that their improvement began 3 years ago with a former player turned executive.
Really, the turning point was when John Paxson took over as executive vice president of basketball operations. Pax, you know, was a broadcaster for the team for many years and also obviously played a fairly integral role in that first three-peat of championships in the early 90s and really understood what it meant to play basketball in Chicago. I mean, Chicago's a city that really embraces blue-collar work ethic and intensity and effort and defense, and that's the kind of player that he really sought.
Those players include guard Kirk Heinrich, who's averaged 15 points a game over his 3-year career, as well as guard Ben Gordon and forward Luol Deng, who have each logged 2 seasons, averaging 16 and 13 points respectively. Heinrich says that the Bulls have emerged from their early growing pains.
I think when all of us got here, you know, we weren't a good team. You know, we kind of developed it into a, you know, contending type team. So we get scoring from a lot of different guys. We don't have one guy who's going to go out there and get you, you know, 25 to 30 every night. And, you know, we rely on playing with each other.
This season, they'll also be able to rely on 6'9" center and super defender Ben Wallace, whom the Bulls acquired as a free agent after 5 years and one NBA title with their divisional rival, the Detroit Pistons. Scott Skiles is already counting the ways that Wallace can help.
He's a rebounder. He's a tough defender. You know, the players have confidence in him. He's got a nice presence. He brings a lot of experience. You know, he's a four-time defensive player of the year, so he brings a lot.
Wallace says he chose the Bulls because his skills were a good fit with their brand of basketball.
The way they play on both ends of the floor, you know, the defensive side of the basketball, I thought it was something that I can, you know, help this team improve at. And, you know, I thought that, you know, what I bring to the table in the direction that the team was heading go hand in hand.
He adds that even though he's the biggest name here since Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, he's hoping to keep a lower profile.
You know, right now I just want to, you know, do whatever I can do to help this team win, try to get guys to realize that, you know, I'm not here to try to take over things, but, you know, I'm here because I wanted to play with those guys.
But the Tribune's Casey Johnson says that Wallace may not be able to avoid the spotlight on a team poised to reach the next level.
If you talk to John Paxson, the general manager, and Scott Skiles, the coach, they're pretty quick to remind you that because they want to see results. And, you know, I certainly think that the expectations are higher and the Bulls have the talent to compete for the Eastern Conference Championship.
The Bulls also have a bright future because they acquired two first-round draft choices when they sent center Eddie Curry to the New York Knicks before last season. Their 2006 pick produced highly regarded forward Tyrus Thomas, the second player chosen overall. And with the Knicks off to a rocky start this season, Chicago may well land another lottery pick in 2007. For now, the Bulls are trying to avoid the sluggish starts of the past two seasons. In 2004, they began with an 0-9 record, and last year they stumbled to 29-39 before turning things around. They're currently 2-3, and Heinrich says the coming month poses a real challenge.
It's huge for us to come out, you know, right away. We have 11 of our first 15 on the road this year, so definitely a tough task. You know, being a lot of close games again. Last year we won a ton of close games, and it's a matter of winning the close games and doing little things at the end of the game.
The Bulls get to play one of those rare home games tonight against the Indiana Pacers. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Chicago.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, schooling jockeys in Kentucky. But first, it's not often you can say a school has just played its first meaningful football game in 137 years, but Rutgers' victory over third-ranked Louisville Thursday signaled the Scarlet Knights' first appearance on the national football scene since 1869. Will it be another century before we see them again? Joining me now to talk about that and other college football matters is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Rutgers knocked off Louisville and knocked them out of the running for the national championship game, and it has also opened up debate amongst fans of 8 or 9 teams with only one loss. They all have a chance to play in the BCS championship game. Are you ready for the weeks of screaming on sports talk radio?
I have got my abacus out, and I'm going to work these computer formulas and figure out who's playing in this game. This is the worst system, worst championship system in any sport. Maybe like a fixed boxing match or something, but other than that, this is about it. I don't believe the Gambino crime family or any of their associates have any computer formulas in the thing. So other than that, this is the most confounding thing. A team like Rutgers could finish it 12-0, be perfect on the season, and not get to play in the championship game because a computer says a team that actually lost is better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every year we rant and rave, and every year we're stuck with the same thing, and all we can do is complain and wring our hands and go crazy about it. This is the plight of the college football fan.
Well, my understanding is that at least one of the spots in that championship game will be determined by one game. Do you think many people will watch the football match between number one Ohio State and second-ranked Michigan 2 weeks from now?
Might be just a little bit of interest in that game, particularly in the Midwest. Yeah, this is going to be a big one. Ohio State and Michigan, of course. A storied rivalry, maybe the best rivalry in all of college football, maybe even all of sport. But they've never met when ranked 1 and 2, despite their years and years of sustained greatness between the two of them. And so this will be a huge game. It is basically the de facto semifinal game in the playoffs. The winner will play in the national championship game, and for a unique change, all these years it's been the opposite, but the loser will have to go to the Rose Bowl, which is not tight, not normal behavior for this game. Usually the winner goes to the Rose Bowl.
Well, would you like to offer your picks for who wins that all-important game and then who the winner faces in the BCS championship game?
Well, I think it's going to be a very good game, but I think I'd give the nod to Ohio State because I think they have better balance offensively and defensively, and they're playing at home. And their coach, Jim Tressel, has been 4-1 against Michigan and knows how to beat Michigan. So I guess I'd give the nod to Ohio State, but I think it's going to be a very, very good game and a very close game. As for the other one, you know, there are so many possibilities to go with really 3 full weeks of play left that honestly any number of 6 or 7 teams could make it. I think Southern California's got a very good chance. I think somebody who comes out of the Southeastern Conference, whether it's Auburn, Arkansas, or the University of Florida, all would have a chance to play for this thing. The University of Texas has got a chance. And I'm still interested to see what happens with the Rutgers because the computers could start to favor them if they end up 12-0. Mm. And so they're not totally out of it. And there's a scenario that the loser of the Ohio State-Michigan game would end up number 2 in the computerized formula, in the formula. So particularly if that's a very close game. So who knows? At this point, picking the other one is virtually impossible.
Ohio State quarterback Troy Smith has been on the top of my personal Heisman Trophy tracker all year, but I get the feeling the rest of the pack may be starting to catch up with him. Is it still Mr. Smith's award to lose, if Smith really is his name?
Yeah, it is his name, as far as I know. I haven't investigated that one, but the problem with the Heisman Trophy is, let's say you're talking baseball, a guy goes out and throws a shutout on opening day, they don't start referring to him as the Cy Young favorite. You kind of let the season play out a little bit, and then about September you go, hey, this guy's 20-4, let's pick him.
Now he's the Cy Young favorite.
Right, now he's the Cy Young favorite. Football, you have a good first week, you're going to win the Heisman. And so that's what Troy Smith did. He's the most important position on the number one team, and he had a couple of very big games early in the season, particularly a very highly watched game against Texas. A lot of votes have probably already been cast, so I think he has a statistical advantage over everyone. But I don't think anyone now, if you've actually watched college football, are going to say, boy, this is clearly the best player in the country. I think there's a number of guys that deserve every bit the impact, but it's as much a political campaign as anything else, and Troy Smith got a huge early jump on this thing. He'll probably end up winning it, even if he isn't the best player in the country.
Well, this is some excellent Heisman talk, and I want to keep it going. Texas quarterback Colt McCoy will likely be among the 5 Heisman finalists. I do love his name. And in an exciting development, it turns out that Hawaii quarterback Colt Brennan may be another finalist. Have there ever been 2 Colts in the finals before?
Not that I recall.
Come on, you're the historian here.
Yeah, I doubt it. But, you know, immediately you say that, someone's going to email you, trust me. This is college football. Colt McCoy, they both do have a chance. I think Colt McCoy might actually make it, although he's young. But if not, I guarantee you that if he doesn't pan out in football, he has a clear shot as a country music singer on name alone.
Dan Wetzel covers college football, maybe country music as well, for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks again for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
So you say you want to don the festively colored silks and ride a powerful thoroughbred around the nation's hallowed racetracks? You're in luck, because the first and only jockey school in the United States began training its first group of students earlier this fall. Kathleen Adams of member station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, recently visited the North American Racing Academy, and she filed this report.
Sunrise is still an hour away, and on this chilly fall morning, the students making up the Academy's inaugural class enter a barn at the Kentucky Horse Park and begin the task of getting 2 mares and 10 geldings ready for the morning's riding lesson. 28-year-old Jessica Oldham removes the blanket from a chestnut thoroughbred named Your Darn Tootin' and begins using a curry comb to groom the former racehorse. At 4'11", Oldham weighs 105 pounds and struggles to reach the gelding's mane and forelock with a brush. Both her parents are former jockeys, and for 10 years, Oldham worked as a racetrack exercise rider. Initially, she didn't feel the two-year associate degree program offered through the Bluegrass Community and Technical College was right for her, but now says it's helped sharpen her skills.
I've learned a tremendous amount about just basic horse knowledge that I never had anyone take time with me to learn, different parts of a horse, what connects to what leads to different illnesses, what leads to different sorenesses, how to treat them, things like that, things that I always wanted to learn but never had time.
Because it generally takes 15 years for jockeys to master the skills of the trade, Oldham considered her age before enrolling in the academy. She'll be 30 at graduation.
I think I'll still have somewhat of an obstacle in my way as far as age goes, but I don't think it's going to be as rough as if I just came from off the track and didn't know anyone and was just, you know, a 28-year-old who never rode races or had never grown up on the racetrack and tried. I think that would be pretty difficult.
The idea of opening a national school for professional jockeys in the United States came to Boston native and Hall of Fame jockey Chris McCarron nearly 20 years ago after he toured the Japan Racing Association's jockey school. Now executive director of the newly opened North American Racing Academy, the two-time Kentucky Derby winning jockey says the facility convinced him that countries such as Japan, Peru, and Australia had the lead when it came to jockey education.
I really find it kind of strange that the United States has, without question, the finest racing in the world. And every other country in the world that has racing has a school for young people to go and learn how to ride. As a matter of fact, any jockey license applicant is required to go through the school before they can go ahead and apply for a license. Now that the United States has a school, I'm very excited about the prospects that this is going to create for young people as far as who wants to be a jockey.
Over the spring and summer, 90 prospective students submitted applications to the North American Racing Academy. 11 were accepted into the program. Each pays close to $4,000 per semester for tuition. Additional funds come from public and private sources, including the Kentucky General Assembly, which contributed $300,000 from the state's general fund. The Kentucky Community and Technical College System also chipped in monies, as did individual racehorse owners and Keeneland Racecourse. McCarron says applicants need to possess a high school diploma or GED and must meet a weight requirement.
As part of our criteria, we would not accept any applicant whose weight exceeded 120 pounds in dressed fashion, which would make them around 113, 114 unclothed. No previous experience working around horses was necessary. We've got 7 individuals here who have never worked around horses at all.
Not willing to simply teach students how to race ride, McCarron says the Racing Academy also sees the need to equip attendees with working knowledge of equine health and nutrition and racetrack and farm management. 20-year-old Matt Strait mucks out the stall belonging to Deuce. The 5'3" New Yorker weighs 112 pounds. He says he can't remember a time when he didn't want to be a jockey. 7 years ago, Strait persuaded his parents to buy him an equisizer, or an unmotorized racehorse simulator.
How much time would you spend on the equisizer?
Oh, every day I could, every chance I got, I'd be on there. You know, I had a TV in front of me and a mirror on the side of me, and just watch replays and races, replays, anything I could watch, and just practice and try to get the rhythm and the motions down.
Growing up a half hour away from Saratoga Racecourse, Strait spent most of his summers at the track befriending high-profile jockeys like Jose Santos, who piloted Funnyside to victory in the 2003 Kentucky Derby. But Strait insists having a journeyman of the caliber of Chris McCarron critiquing and analyzing his every move is invaluable.
I was actually at the Breeders' Cup the 2 times he won the Classic on Tisnow, so it's awesome to have someone like that, you know, watching us and being able to teach us the correct position, the correct form. And you really got to take that information serious and really really hone down on your riding style and pay attention to what he has to say.
After graduation, Strait fully expects to don the silks. But if for some reason he doesn't, Strait says the Racing Academy will have well prepared him for other careers within the equine industry. And that was something a liberal arts curriculum couldn't offer. 22-year-old Corey Mongan of Hagerstown, Maryland, agrees. He was preparing to enroll at a four-year university when a friend told him about the Racing Academy. Despite the objections of his mother, who wanted him to be a teacher, Mongan moved to Kentucky. At 5'5" and 115 pounds, Mongan is one of several students who entered the academy with no prior horse experience, and he admits just learning basic horseback riding maneuvers hasn't been easy.
It was frustrating at first. Actually, the first day, I had a Mustang named Eagle that almost ran out of the barn with me on him. But I'm starting to get the hang of it. A lot of us that just started, we keep asking, you know, when are we going to ride a thoroughbred? When are we going to ride a thoroughbred? But Chris keeps telling us, be careful what you wish for.
No, 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 no. If you guys let a horse turn because the other one's turned, you're not in control.
Chris McCarron hopes to expand the program by raising $15 million to build additional barns, dormitories, and classrooms at the horse park, and expects to increase the 2007 class size to include 15 students.
Get a little bit closer.
For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Lexington, Kentucky.
So my point is, if you allow these horses to just follow, you're not in control.
You're listening to Only a Game. Many listeners from the Southwest to the Northeast thoroughly enjoyed Karen Given's story in last week's show about Kenyan marathoners and the High Altitude Training Center in E10. Dwight Wheeler, who hears the show on KJZZ in Phoenix, was among them, as was Pete Wyazowski, who hears us on Vermont Public Radio. Another Vermont Public Radio listener, Nora Paley, wrote, "The report about Kenya was thrilling and beautiful and large in so many ways. I want to hear it again." You can do that, Ms. Paley, by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. WBUR listener Justin Verderame enjoyed the story, too, but he wrote to point out that at one point Karen said of some of the Kenyan runners that they had climbed 4,000 feet over 13 miles in 47 minutes. The current world record for a half marathon, which is 13.1 miles, is 58 minutes and 55 seconds, and that was without a 4,000-foot climb, he wrote. Something is a little off. Mr. Verderame is correct. Ms. Given meant to say 1 hour and 47 minutes. Several people responded to a letter I read in last week's program from a listener who wanted more football, baseball, and basketball coverage and fewer stories about obscure sports. Representative was an email from WBUR listener Allison Howe, who wrote, "The coverage of sports other than baseball, basketball, football, and hockey is precisely what I love about Only a Game. The chance to hear about any type of athletic endeavor, the well-known to the obscure, the fully serious to the lighthearted, I say keep up the great work." Cheryl Benson emailed regarding my conversation on last week's program with Mike Freeman, the author of a biography of football great Jim Brown. "Kudos times 10 for your handling of the Jim Brown book author on the domestic violence issue," she wrote. "You gotta wonder about the publisher putting hero in the title. I'm a regular listener and a former sports writer for the LA Times, and I love the perspective you bring to sports." You can tell us what you think of the stories on Only a Game by calling the listener line, 617-353-1860. Our mailing address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. But the easiest way to reach us is via the aforementioned website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a dramatic rendering of a night in November, 23 years ago. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The results of Tuesday's election have not suffered from lack of analysis, but who among the illustrious former athletes won, and which ones will have to look for honest work?
Excuse me for just a moment. I'm sorry that had to come out. Actually, the Republican Party's stranglehold on former NFL players was finally broken, not only because Heath Shuler, the former Redskins quarterback, won his congressional seat in the western part of North Carolina, but Lynn Swann, Football Hall of Famer, former Pittsburgh Steelers, did his best to take the entire Pennsylvania Republican Party down with him. I actually had a friend of mine who pointed out that somewhere Vince Ferragamo is sitting in his den and wondering why Lynn Swann couldn't have been that incompetent 30 years ago.
One athlete who won this week is Michelle Kwan, and she didn't even have to campaign. Will the perky figure skater help the Bush administration in the goodwill department?
Well, someone has to, I suppose, and she's as good a candidate as any. Michelle Kwan is a charming woman. She'll go all over the world and show people the smiling face of America, which I think is probably a good thing.
Major League Soccer's champion will be determined tomorrow afternoon when the New England Revolution beat the Houston Dynamo. Actually, would you care to explain why, no matter the result, Scotland wins?
Yes, because the Houston coach was born in Glasgow, and the Revolution coach was born in Croon. So as we all say around the MLS,
here it comes.
If it's not Scottish, it's crap!
Having played quite well in D.C. United's loss to the Revs in last weekend's conference championship, Freddy Adu has captured the attention of a pretty popular club across the pond. Are the child labor laws less strict in Old Trafford?
Let's see if we can work out the meter and the melody for the latest one. Ole, 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 Man U, Freddy Adu. Ole. Yeah,
not
he's going to go. He's going to go over and play for the big timiest of the big time soccer teams. I imagine that D.C. United will get a hefty transfer fee, which the Man U can probably pay out of petty cash at this point, and he's going to go play with the big guys.
It looks as if we could have a BCS championship that involves Rutgers and Boise State. Charlie, are we living in a topsy-turvy football world?
Well, only if you feed the BCS voters mushrooms. They're going to get a BCS championship game that involves Ohio State, Michigan, Texas, Southern Cal, or some other large corporate entity. But the Big East finds itself with three teams with one loss, all of them very good, all of them very entertaining. Rutgers beat heretofore undefeated Louisville on Thursday night in an extremely entertaining game. And Rutgers will go to a bowl game with a bunch of seniors who were 1-11. And one of them pointed out that when he was a freshman, he was booed off the field and his car got smashed with a beer bottle, which latter, of course, is only a sign of affection in New Jersey.
Absolutely. Less than 24 hours after one of their players was shot to death, the University of Miami football team was back at practice this week. Coach Larry Coker said, "You've got to get back."
Well,
has he got his priorities right?
I don't know. What do you do if you don't play, if you don't practice? Do you sit around your dormitory and be morose? If you choose to handle your grief in such a way that you decide to go practice football, I'm not going to make a big deal out of that. I'm really not.
The National Football League has been in operation for a long time now, Charlie. Why do players still sometimes tell reporters that the guys they're about to face are, quote, beatable?
Don't they understand yet that you're not supposed to tell people the truth?
There's bulletin boards in those locker rooms, darn it.
I know, and at least 85% of the players can read them, right? I'm channeling Bill Littlefield here. I don't know how that started. Plaxico Burress, the wide receiver for the New York Giants, are called the Chicago Bears cornerbacks very beatable, and we'll see if he's right this weekend when the two teams play. He happens to be right, but as you point out, nothing gets the old blood a-stirring like somebody telling the truth about your own abilities.
Trevor Graham, the man who blew the whistle on Balco, was indicted last week for making false statements to federal agents, and now USADA is trying to ban him from coaching. Should Graham have swallowed that whistle?
Well, if you're going to blow the whistle, it's very important that you be clean yourself. And Graham's had a terrible year. He was Justin Gatlin's coach, and Justin Gatlin is now facing an 8-year ban after a positive test. At some level, the rats all begin to turn on themselves, and this is going to cost Graham a hell of a lot more than his career.
Jeff Gordon, the driver NASCAR fans love, except for the ones who hate him, got married on Tuesday. Broken hearts from Talladega to the Poconos.
Yes, and a lot of other people who point out that he married a model and that makes him a less than manly man and shouldn't be driving a NASCAR. I'd say it's about 50-50 at this point.
Okay, a quiz. We've seen twice as many technical fouls in the young NBA season as we had at this point last year. That means, A, the players are committing more fouls, B, the referees are getting tougher, C, the players' union is going to file a lawsuit, D, all of the above.
Well, I think the answer is D. There's always been a problem in every field when you empower the power mad. And that's pretty much what the NBA has done with this new no demonstrations of any kind rule. The NBA officials who've been waiting for this for 4 or 5 years are taking their vengeance out. The game is slowing down. Players are getting technicals piled up. Pretty soon it's going to start involving fines. It's a stupid rule to start with, and if you're going to have a stupid rule, please enforce it well, and they haven't done that yet.
This week, LeBron James joined the group of players who have complained about the new basketball in the NBA. So now do we go back to the old ball?
I don't know. I still can't figure this out. Don't they use the same ball in practice?
I assume that.
So are all of NBA practices just this festival of clanging shots now? Or does it just happen when they get in the game? It's becoming rather general around the league, though, and they might want to rethink this.
College basketball is underway, Charlie. The Maryland women's team was supposed to mature last season and win it all this season, and then they went and won it all last season. So are they too mature to win this season?
Well, the interesting thing you have, of course, is you have two teams, one national championships, Florida for the men and Maryland for the women, who are bringing everybody back, particularly with the men. This has not been the case for a while. So, yes, you have two teams with huge bullseyes on their backs. I think Florida's got a better chance of repeating than Maryland does. Maryland plays in an incredibly tough league in the Atlantic Coast Conference. Florida is far and away the best team in their conference and will have a period in the season when they can coast.
The San Diego Padres hired former pitcher Bud Black as a manager this week, Charlie. Are the front office people in San Diego unaware that bad players make the best managers?
I have no idea. Bud Black was actually a pretty good pitcher.
He was a good pitcher.
He was the pitching coach for the Angels when they won the World Series, and he's got one World Series ring of his own. He pitched in the majors for 15 years. He was on the Kansas City team that won the 1985 World Series. I think there's a loophole for pitchers, though. I think pitchers are entitled to be good and good managers.
And finally, Charlie, Michael Jordan, Allen Iverson, Stephon Marbury, they all are prepared to sell you sneakers, but how about the newest entry into the trainers market?
Imelda Marcos, famous for her shoes. Famous for her shoes and her ability to get out of Dodge with most of the shoes and all of her
and
money.
All the money.
Yes. has launched the Imelda collection, a range of low-cost but glitzy jewelries, bags, and trainers.
Meaning
training shoes. I'll tell you what. Any marathon which requires you to get out of town in a hurry, wear the Marcos shoes because they're proven successes.
Charlie Pierce, size 10 in the high-heeled sneaker, right?
He writes and my wig Boston, hat on my head.
He writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks,
Charlie. Thanks, Bill.
If you're a technophobe like me, you may wonder what a podcast is. Let's consult the dictionary. Pod, a school of marine mammals, such as seals, whales, or dolphins. Cast, to throw with force or hurl. So if you'd like to throw dolphins with force, hurl whales, or listen to all of Only a Game's weekly offerings, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. In a small basement theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, actor Marty McGuire steps under a spotlight to present A Night in November. The stage is bare, but for a set of three steps that will shortly represent the grandstand at a soccer match. As the play opens, Kenneth Norman McAllister begins recalling a most significant journey.
That day started out like any other day starts out. You know, checking underneath the car for explosive devices. Well, no, you have to be one step ahead of these bastards. They keep advancing their technology on you. These days, they can blow you up with a device no bigger than a box of matches. But they'll not get me.
It's the autumn of 1993, and Kenneth McAllister, a Protestant resident of Belfast, Northern Ireland, is fooling himself, as his wife is about to tell him in shriveling terms he's an idiot to think he's important enough to be a target for the IRA. He's a clerk in the Dole office, for goodness sake. Henpecked, small-minded, taking what comfort he can from the fact that at least he's not a Catholic, Kenneth McAllister has been doing his wife's bidding for as long as he can recall. So it's no surprise that a few days after he starts his car without getting blown up, at her behest, he's driving his hacking, wheezing father-in-law, Ernie, to a soccer match between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland at Windsor Park Stadium in Belfast.
I don't like football, Ernie, so I hope you appreciate this. You don't like football? Jesus Christ. You're not a man at all, so I worry about you, you know that? You worry about me?
Marty McGuire plays the parts of Kenneth and Ernie. He also plays Kenneth's wife. In fact, McGuire plays all 26 of the play's characters, men, women, and children. And once Kenneth and Ernie reach Windsor Park Stadium, he's convincing as several thousand people attending the game, not to see soccer, but to roar for their own embattled counties and scream insults at the players representing the Republic.
No!
What's going on here, Ernie? Is this a football match? Or a bunch of lions waiting for the Christians? What the hell is going on here, Ernie? Oh, they've got blood in their nostrils, Kenny. Fenian blood.
At their worst on that November day 13 years ago, the supporters of the home team shouted vile things at the opposition. Trick or treat, they screamed, and Grey Steel 7, Ireland nil. A reminder of the Halloween slaughter of seven innocent people by gunmen just days before the match. Inspired by those events, Mari Jones wrote A Night in November, the play with a cast of one that tells the story of the awakening of Kenneth Norman McAllister. Genuinely frightened by his father-in-law and the bellowing bigots surrounding him, Kenneth tries to help a fan of the Irish team mouth the words to a song the supporters of Northern Ireland are singing so that the lonely Catholic fan won't be found out and beaten. That scene isn't much of a stretch for Marty McGuire, who spoke to me after a recent performance and said he'd learned tolerance early.
My mother was fantastic in keeping me on the straight and narrow, to make me very aware that there's good and bad in all, in both sides. And in Ireland, there was only two sides. It was Protestant and Catholic. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't race, it wasn't sexual persuasion, it was nothing. It was Catholic and Protestant. So she refused to allow me to be that way.
A little later in the play, Kenneth McAllister finds himself examining the circumstances of his own stunted life. He visits his boss, a Catholic who lives in a neighborhood wrapped in barbed wire and choked with soldiers, and finds that the man is happier in his home than Kenneth is in his own. Without giving away too much of a plot that continues to involve soccer and Kenneth McAllister's discovery of genuine friendship once he's grown beyond prejudice, it's fair to say A Night in November manages to be at once a work of art and a moral lesson. The play first came to the attention of Marty McGuire when he was tending bar in Los Angeles. Initially, he was alarmed at the idea of playing so many parts, but eventually he decided to try out A Night in November as a reading at a Southern California pub.
The place was packed because I'd known a lot, you know, over the years, and people had seen our pub theater and they enjoyed it. You know, it's something very different for Los Angeles. And they came on a Friday night, $10, all-you-can-eat Irish stew, and me with a microphone and two light bulbs doing this show from the script, and it got a standing ovation. And I was like, oh, my God, I think I'm onto something here.
McGuire has since performed a night in November in New York, London, Edinburgh, and Dublin. He's also been back to Belfast, where he was happy to see that life had improved considerably since his boyhood there.
You don't get searched going into the city anymore. You don't get searched going into the stores anymore. And just coexisting in a wonderful, thriving atmosphere and environment. And I kept saying, if they had 3 weeks a month of my childhood, they go, no, and no, there's no way we're ever going back to that. And that's the hope for the future, you know. And in the next generation, it will hopefully be even better.
If the troubles in Ireland are less apparent these days than they were when Mari Jones wrote A Night in November, the play is no less powerful than it was a dozen years ago. Following performances, Marty McGuire has been approached by audience members who've told him the drama is less about the conflict in Ireland than it is about the human condition. Though he's happy about their appreciation, he says the greatest review he's ever received came from a woman for whom the play's particulars were especially significant.
We received a letter from a woman who said that she was dragged kicking and screaming to see the play because for 20-something years she had avoided all things Irish. Wouldn't even eat Irish butter because her husband was a British soldier who had been really very badly maimed in a bomb serving in Northern Ireland in the 70s. He lost an eye, he lost an arm. She said, but after what, I stuck with it, and after a while the magic of the piece took over, but this one single man in his little insignificant existence, in his job, who was willing to take off the blinkers of bigotry. She says, as a result of your performance in the play, I have just taken the first step on the road to healing, a road I never thought I would be on. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
The current run of Marty McGuire's one-man show, A Night in November, has recently been extended. He'll be performing the play at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway in Somerville, Massachusetts, from now until December 10th. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Elias Feldman. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view our Night in November photo gallery, learn more about the one-man play, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from actor Marty McGuire, who recalls his soccer-loving days as a Belfast youth.
I was a lunatic for a soccer club called Liverpool. Liverpool, I was a madman for those when I was a kid, but when I came to America, I sort of lost all track of that.
Just don't tell me you now fancy American football. That's not the case, is it, lad? It'd break my heart. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is